Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we have got a spirit-focused show for you, which seems perfect for Halloween. But we're not talking spooky spirits. Rather, we'll be talking about the upcoming Spirit and Place Festival. This year's theme is power, and among the more than 30 events that take place as part of the festival, one seemed particularly appropriate to discuss here on the show. The Power of Food, 7 short stories, will focus on short stories told by a variety of indie residents in a competitive format, and the audience will vote on the most powerful story. Teresa Vernon, Regional Director for the Kitchen Community in Indianapolis, tells us about the event. We'll also talk about spirits of another sort when we check in with Blake Jones, one of the founders of West Fork Whiskey in Indianapolis, which has its grand opening November 3rd. The new distillery is unveiling its whiskey cocktail bar at its facility at 17th and Bellefontaine Streets. And since we were in the neighborhood, we also stopped in at Cannonball Brewing Company, situated right across the street from West Fork Whiskey, to talk about the brewery's first anniversary. We sat down with owner and brewer Mark Swartz and chef Aaron Kim to find out how the first year has gone. So stay with us for more here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We're talking spirits today here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. And first up, we mean spirits of the distilled variety. Central Indiana has a growing number of craft distilleries, and West Fork Whiskey will unveil its cocktail bar tasting room with a November 3rd grand opening. The distillery, which began with a production facility on the city's north side, is now located at 17th and Bellefontaine Streets in Indianapolis, where co-founder Blake Jones and partners have created an inviting new whiskey bar where they distill, age, and bottle the spirits. But just how do you go about starting a distillery? West Fork's Blake Jones tells us how it all happened. So we've talked with you before about West Fork Whiskey when it was in more of the development stages. So let's start at the beginning. So take me through the process. When did all of this start?
Yeah, so it really started in 2014 when my one of my partners and I cashed our 401ks and went out and got a loan and decided to start making whiskey. So that's when we officially started the company. Then got all our docs filed and everything, but the permitting process and getting all our initial equipment in took quite a while. So we started production in late 2015 on the northwest side of Indy.
So why whiskey? Why did you decide? Do you have a background in this sort of thing, distilling or food or drink or beverage, you know?
I don't. Okay. You know, we're former bankers, actually, two of us. And the third was, you know, my brother and our production manager is our third co-founder. And, you know, he's a scientist by training. And we love the spirit. We all are whiskey drinkers, big whiskey drinkers. You know, we thought it was a shame that so much corn went to Kentucky and Tennessee to make their whiskeys. And, you know, we're on the same water aquifer. If limestone water makes good whiskey and corn makes good whiskey, then there's no reason why Indiana shouldn't have some of the best whiskey produced right here. So that was kind of really why we started the company. We love the spirit, thought the state really needed its own whiskey distillery that it could be proud of at a large scale level.
So you got into it out of love for the product.
That's
then.
Right. And the state.
And the state, exactly. So how do you go about starting a distillery? I mean, this can't be easy.
Besides money and a lot of time, like any business owner, entrepreneur, and someone taking a risk for something, it's always more expensive. It always takes longer than you think. And you know, we were working 7 days a week. You know, we had our day jobs, nights and weekends for a long time. And then we decided to scale the company up, get our production manager, you know, Julian, our third co-founder, in there full time, and much, much larger equipment, still helping him on the nights and the weekends. And then we've all been full time now for quite a while. So, you know, it's just love and hard work, right? I mean, when you have a dream and you decide to go for it, you got to go all in. And so we push the chips in, and you know, we don't artificially color, filter, or flavor our whiskeys in any way, which is fairly unique, actually, in the whiskey market. So, you know, we're going for it, and we're working hard. And, you know, you take two steps forward and maybe one step back, or three steps back and right. half a step forward, and then, you know, four steps back, whatever.
So, but you've been distilling whiskey now for a couple of years?
Yeah, about 2 years right? now.
Now, how was that? How was it to get started on that? Did you get started small, or did you buy the big equipment and...
No, we, you know, it was just three kids trying to make some whiskey. So we didn't, you know, have a bunch of money. We didn't have a bunch of partners. And so we started on 50-gallon still, really small batches. Again, just nights and weekends. And then we scaled up a little over a year ago onto a 1,000-liter system.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is, you know, a fairly decent size production system. And we've been producing on that for, again, a little over a year now, about a year and a half, actually. So it's, you know, started really, really small, and now it's finally getting a little bigger. We're really excited.
But now whiskey isn't something like beer or wine that you can be a home distiller, you know, because you people brew beer at home, they make wine at home, but you can't do that with spirits, right?
No, it's illegal to do it at home. So, you know, when we wanted our first test batch, we had to do it after our DSP came in, our federal DSP in Indiana gave us the okay. You know, so it was.
So you have to make that commitment.
Yeah,
in a
you
big way.
If you want to do it the right way, you absolutely do. And so our first batch, the guys over at Great Fermentation and ladies and guys over at Great Fermentations were great to us. They gave us some wine they didn't want, some beer they didn't want, and so we actually distilled that as a test batch. That, you know, had nothing
well,
to do
great.
With whiskey. It was just testing our equipment. They were going to toss that stuff anyways, and you know, it really worked out great. The product actually wasn't that bad. And then we moved on to whiskey and started doing our test batches with whiskey. And to your point, you know, it takes a little while. We use smaller casks, so we use a mix of 5, 10, and 15-gallon casks, and you know, designed a completely unique process to go really well, and mash bills go really well with some smaller casks. So we just really started outward bound marketing about 6 months ago. So
how's it been? What's been the reaction to the products?
We've been really fortunate. You know, one of the biggest feedbacks we get is we make a really, really clean spirit.
Now, what does that mean?
I mean, in distillation, there are three cuts to every distillation run. There's a head's cut, a heart's cut, and a tail's cut. And, you know, some whiskey people will claim they, you know, they want a little heads in there, and they definitely want tails in there. We only use hearts, which is the most cleanest, the cleanest tasting of the spirits. So that makes us a little unique in that we don't use tails in any of our product. And they're just different chemical compounds. We really just want the ethanol. So... You know, it's that's been the biggest feedback we've got. You know, we're in about 150 accounts throughout the state, so we're growing rapidly. Some of the, you know, some really cool cocktail bars. I'm sorry if I missed some of them here, but have picked us up and have been really good to us, like Bluebeard, Ball and Biscuit, mm-hmm. Spoke and Steel, The Garden Table. I mean, we've been really fortunate to have some really good partners helping, and on the retail side, you know, Crown, Big Red, Belmont, up north.
Oh, sure. So people can find your whiskey already.
Oh, yeah. All over. Find it, buy it, buy it again.
Right. But the news is that the tasting room is almost ready to open, right?
Man, it's been a long 2 years. So, you know, the laws governing distilling in Indiana are much different than breweries, wineries, and cideries. They can be open to the public immediately and have that consumer-facing brand right off the bat. Until this last legislative session, it was a 3-year wait until we could be open to the public immediately. So that's why, you know, we started in a warehouse on the north side. But, you know, we moved to 17th Bellefontaine and the Kennedy King neighborhood, a really up-and-coming, awesome neighborhood. I've been fortunate to find that spot. And finally going to be, I hate it. Technically, yes, it's a tasting room, but I hate calling it that because it really is a whiskey cocktail bar.
Okay.
And so we want to be known for both traditional and non-traditional whiskey cocktails, but whiskey. So it's definitely more than a tasting room. Yeah, you can get flights, you can get pours of our whiskey, but we're going to offer 15 to 20 cocktails. And the concept
goodness.
Is this kind of modern, cool, intimate whiskey cocktail bar in the middle of a production whiskey distillery. So it's glass enclosed.
So people can see the production space?
Oh, yeah. So it really is really unique, one of a kind. We're excited to get it open and really start to let people interact with us and get to know our personalities, get to know the brand a little bit better and make it a little bit easier, again, to get to know West Fork Whiskey.
Well, now tell me a little bit about the origin of the name, West Fork Whiskey.
Yeah, we wanted, you know, with all of our stuff, you know, all of our products have, we're corn heavy through all of our products, and, you know, bourbon has to be 51% corn, but sure. Across all of our products, we're corn heavy to pay homage to the state. And we wanted our name of the company to do so without being too in your face, especially as we cross state lines and get sold in other states.
Right.
So the West Fork of the White River flows to Indianapolis. Those is much of the state. And so it was a kind of subtle nod to the river that really helped sustain and start the city early on.
Now, what kind of how many products do you have, and what will people be able to find when they come to the new cocktail room, cocktail bar, right?
Yeah. So right now on the shelves we've got three products. We've got an unaged corn whiskey, an aged corn whiskey, which is pretty unique because there aren't really many aged corn whiskeys on the market. You might find one other if you go to any liquor store around here besides ours, and a weeded bourbon.
Okay.
So those are the first three we have out. We're about to launch two additional products. We're going to launch Third Degree, which is actually a cinnamon-infused whiskey. One thing that, again, we don't want to ever artificially color, filter, or flavor our whiskey in any way. So if you look at Fireball and it's 30 ingredients and half of them can kill you,
were
like, why do people drink this? Why does this even exist in the market? So ours has four ingredients, simple syrup, our whiskey, you know, cinnamon sticks and dried red chilies. That's it. So it's going to be made in the right way. We got a rye-based bourbon coming out, just two ingredients in that, corn and rye. And then we have actually one more coming out later this year is a traditional rye whiskey. We do have some specialty stuff put back, but I'll got to be hush on those for a little while.
We've been talking with Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey. We'll be right back with more from Blake here on eDrink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back today talking with Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey. West Fork will have the grand opening of its whiskey bar at its new distillery at 17th and Bellefontaine Streets in Indianapolis. It's an up-and-coming neighborhood, not far from the Monon Trail and the emerging 16th Street corridor. But as Blake tells us, it took a little vision to see the potential in the building and to turn it into both a production facility and a cool new whiskey bar. So tell me a little bit about the process of creating the space at 17th and Bellefontaine. That's in an emerging neighborhood, a lot of development going on in that area. Cannonball Brewing Company is right across the street from you. Tell me a little bit about, you know, growing the business there.
Yeah, so about a year ago, we saw an article in the newspaper that said there's a cool new brewery opened up, and here's the property company that's developing that kind of area, Reveal Properties. And I just literally gave him a call and was like, hey, we're looking for space. We looked in, everywhere from Irvington to Fountain Square to anywhere downtown close to Mass Ave to Speedway to Broad Ripple, looked in a ton of different locations. And we went to breakfast with Karen Jason, the two owners of Reveal Properties, and we're like, what do you have available? And we went and saw the space, and it used to be a grocery store way back in the day, and then it was a makeshift church. Now it's a whiskey distillery.
But it was a pretty rough-looking building, if I remember right.
Really rough.
You know, so could you see the potential?
We could, but, you know, we're dreamers, right? We're always dreaming, and we could see through it. We kept with a lot of the building, so it's, you know, exposed beams, exposed brick. Did have to lay new floors, kept a lot of some of the facade. They put cedar shiplap up on the outside, which looks amazing. But, you know, it took about 8 months, a year to really build it out. It's been going on for a long time behind the scenes. And the neighborhood has been nothing but positive reaction there. I mean, we've really been fortunate. We kind of look smarter than we are now that some other news about investment in the area have come out. You know, it was kind of what we were hoping for.
Right.
You know, we saw, you know, it's close to downtown. You know, people want to come to the Indy Core. So we just kind of got lucky, and we saw potential in that building. We thought it was awesome with all the exposed old brick, and, you know, perfect space for us. So it's really worked out really well.
So now the distilling equipment is right there as well, right?
Yeah, we're moving everything there. So moved our still and our mash tun down not too long ago. All of our barrels, which was a really fun process to move, a few hundred barrels, 400 barrels down there, and 1,000 liter still and a 2,000 liter mash tun. So I mean, it was really a big process to get stuff down there. But it's all going down there. We're going to produce, age,
all right,
everything
there.
Right there. We'll never buy a spirit from somebody else. Everything that you buy from us, we have done everything from mash to age it, to bottle it, to everything.
All right there.
All right there.
Well, you said you were labeling bottles right before we were talking.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Sorry again for being a little late today, but we literally hand label everything.
So this is a real craft facility.
Oh, it absolutely is. We do everything, again, the right way, and we do it by hand. I mean, when we say small batch, some of our batches are as small as 160 bottles. So it's not like, hate to say it, Maker's Mark makes good whiskey, but they might have 15,000 bottles in a batch and call it small batch. There's no legal term.
But yours really are small.
It's small. Oh, yeah. It's real small, which is good, which is good for now. So.
Well, now tell me about what people might see when you have the grand opening, November 3rd, when people can come in and see the new space. What's it going to be like?
It's going to be cool. You'll be able to, take tours, walk around the space, get great cocktails. We're going to have live music. We're going to have a food menu from provided by Cannonball Brewing. So you can order their food from our cocktail bar, get it delivered to your table. Check out on the same ticket. So it'll feel like we have a kitchen, but we won't have a kitchen. So that's great.
Well, that's a nice fortuitous situation there that you've come up with.
Well, we've gotten really lucky. Aaron, their chef over there, and Mark,
Aaron
their
Kim,
owner,
that's right. Awesome chef.
They're awesome. We got lucky that they were there and we happened to get next door, and they've been really willing to, create some cool partnerships with us, one of them being the food.
Right.
So you could be able to really interact with the brand, get some awesome cocktails, and we're not 10, 12, 13 bucks for a cocktail. You come to West Fork Whiskey, you're paying $8 or $9. So you're not paying those high prices. You can get a poor whiskey for, as low as $4 and $6. So we want to be really reasonable.
So now are you highlighting your own spirits? So this is all just your own spirits,
legally,
right?
We have to. Mm-hmm. We can't sell anything in there or make cocktails with anything we don't produce in-house. So if it has alcohol in it, we have to produce it if it's going to go in a cocktail. Bitters and shrubs and certain things, we might be able to buy some of those, even though they technically might have some alcohol in them. But legally, it's only our spirits.
It's all
going
your stuff.
Into everything. So.
Oh no, that could be a challenge. So your cocktail menu is determined by what you're making, or are you making things for the cocktail menu?
A little bit of both. We're going to stick to whiskey. Don't do anything, and we don't get crazy when it comes to the whiskeys we produce. Really,
so this is a whiskey bar, right?
Yeah, it's a whiskey cocktail bar. Absolutely, I don't want to sell anybody on something that's not. we say we're going to have a cocktail for everybody, though. We're going to have traditionals, non-traditionals. Some of the traditionals are going to have a twist because we might not be able to put vermouth in a cocktail. So we're going to come up with it. It's going to be the same style, but it might not have vermouth, and it might taste a little different, but it'll be a riff on the cocktail. So it'll be a cool menu. I think, again, we'll have a cocktail for everybody, and it's only our stuff.
Well, now that's very interesting, very cool and focused, absolutely focused. Just a whiskey cocktail bar. So, what else do you see for West Fork? Do you see it growing even more? I mean, it's been a busy few years.
We laughed about this last time. World domination.
That's right. That's exactly right. So you have big plans.
Yeah, I mean, really, we want West Fork and. To be known all over the country. I mean, we want people to think, when they think whiskey and they think Indiana, they think West Fork whiskey. And I know that's a huge dream, and there's some other good producers in the state who do some great stuff. Mm-hmm. And we love that. It only helps, build distilling in general to some other people who are doing a dang good job of it. So it helps everybody, just like the brew scene, all helped each other. But yeah, we want to be sold, in all 50 states internationally eventually. I mean, we really want to make great whiskey, make it right here in Indiana, do it with 100% Indiana ingredients, and sell it everywhere. That's the goal.
That's all, right?
Yeah, right. That's it. That's the small goal that we have.
So now, how has it been along the way having to learn the process. So now you've all clearly become, you know, whiskey aficionados, experts on the type of whiskey that you make. What's it been like as a learning process?
Well, do you know the definition of crazy? That's kind of what it is.
Is that right?
You know, I kind of mentioned it earlier. You take a step or two forward and maybe five back. I mean, it's been a learning experience, everything, you know, with our distribution partners to retail partners to, you know, managing it and managing operations and trying to figure out what's selling, not selling, what might sell, you know, two, three, four, five years down the road to plan production. I hate to say it because we kind of poke fun at ourselves, but sometimes I feel like we're flying by the seat of our pants. And, you know, you just got to take risks and you got to go for it. And if you believe in what you do and you make a good product at a good price, I mean, we think we'll be just fine. But it's been a lot and very overwhelming. And you can talk to any of our significant others that sometimes we drive them crazy. So,
but has it been fun though? I mean, it seems like it's kind of a dream that a lot of people have.
Hell of a lot of fun. Sorry for my language. But it has been so, so fun and so rewarding to build something from scratch or, you know, to go to a random Walmart in Lafayette and I see West Fork whiskey on the shelf.
That must be cool. I mean, really.
It's awesome. It really is incredible. It's not fun every day. Nothing is.
It's still
work, but... We're starting to finally have some fun with it, and you know, again, this new cocktail bar and our new tasting room is only going to help us have even more fun.
Well, now, where can people find more information? They can find you on social media?
Yeah, at West Fork Whiskey on all social media. We don't really tweet, but we love Instagram. We love Facebook and www.westforkwhiskey.com. You know, Google us, you know, whatever.
But, so what are the hours going to be for the new whiskey cocktail bar?
Oh, man, I may have this wrong, but we'll be closed Monday, Tuesdays for now. Open at 4 on Wednesdays and Thursdays till 9, 4 to 10 on Fridays. And I think on Saturdays and Sundays opening at 1. At Saturdays closing at, I think, 8, and Sundays maybe closing at 6.
Oh, well, goodness. So people will have plenty of opportunities to come in and check it out.
Absolutely. Hope they do, and hope they do it often.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking today with Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey. For more information on the distillery, look for it on Facebook or go to westforkwhiskey.com. I'm Jolene Kenzenberger, and we are back here today on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, focusing for the moment on the up-and-coming corner at 17th and Bellefontaine Streets in Indianapolis. Just about a year ago, Cannonball Brewing Company opened in a former grocery store building that dates back to the 1890s. The neighborhood has embraced the small brewery, which has become known for its food as well as its beer. Owner and brewer Mark Swartz and Chef Aaron Kemp tell us about the first year in business, and also about the connection with neighboring West Fork Whiskey. What kind of a year has it been?
I think it's been amazing. Again, this was the first time I've done anything like this, so I don't really have much to compare it to, but we're still here and we're doing well, and I'm having a blast.
Well, tell me a little bit about the name of the business and how that all came about, because if we're starting from the beginning, I guess that's the beginning.
Right. Well, Cannonball Baker was actually an Indianapolis resident also, and he won the first motorized event at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and it was a motorcycle race in 1909. And he won that race, and then after that, a lot of car and motorcycle companies would hire him to go coast to coast to set speed records, and he became famous. New York Times reporter wrote that he was faster than the Wabash Cannonball is how he got his nickname.
That's perfect, right? And you have a connection to motorcycles as well.
Yes, I used to race motorcycles when I was younger, and I just have been a lifelong fan of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, too. So
it all ties together,
yes.
Right? And you have some memorabilia in the brewery?
Yes. Yeah, I have the fairing for my old race bike, and then pictures of Cannonball Baker in here.
So tell me back, let's go back to this time last year, you know, and what was it like just getting started. How long did it take to get up and going?
It took almost a year to do the build out. The building was just kind of a shell when we first started, and it was, gosh, yeah, it was about a year to get everything started.
So what was it? What was the reaction when you first opened? Was it, you know, positive?
It was. We've had a lot of. It's been great.
So you've had a good reaction to the neighborhood. Now it is an emerging neighborhood. Unit 17th and Bellefontaine. What's it been like to sort of become integrated into the neighborhood?
It's been really exciting to be a part of the existing neighborhood already. A lot of longtime residents come in now and are regulars, and it's been really a lot of fun.
Now, describe the brewery a little bit, because it's a very small operation, right?
Right. It's very small. It's a two-barrel brewing system. It's all done down in the basement, so it's very, very small.
So what sorts of beers do you turn out? Do you have a specialty? Anything that you like to focus on?
No, it's all over the place. That's why it keeps it so much fun for me that way. You kind of never really know what's going to be on tap.
Now, what was your background in brewing beer? Had you done that for a long time?
I've been a home brewer for about 13 years before I started this, and then kind of one of those people that hangs around all the breweries and hangs around great fermentations all the time. I was one of those people.
And so that just led to starting a brewery. I mean, that's kind of a dream of a lot of home brewers, I would imagine. But how did you get to the point of actually saying, okay, I'm going to start a brewery?
I've been in aviation my whole adult life, and it was just time for a change.
Well, this is definitely a change, but it seems like it's a very fun change.
It has been fun. I really enjoy it. It's, I don't know, I love it.
Well, now, talk a little bit about the food here, and then we'll talk with the chef, Aaron Kim. So what was the thought when you originally wanted to open? Did you have plans for the food?
Honestly, when we first started making the plans for it, the food was more of an afterthought. And when Aaron became available, we just were, I said, anything you want to make here, the food is all yours if you want to come work here.
Well, now, Aaron, tell me a little bit about how you went about creating a menu for a brewery and also a menu in a very small space.
Right. I think beer and food go well together. It's easier to pair beer and food. And I just started kind of brainstorming, coming up with a size of a menu that I could handle myself and that foodies would be into and that I could handle in this tiny kitchen.
Well, now, what kind of a menu is that? Can you describe the food here? If someone asks you what kind of food you serve, could you tell them?
That's hard because it's kind of all over the place ethnically, and I change it quarterly, I'd say. Fit for foodies, for sure. I don't know, upscale, I don't know, gastropub, I don't know.
So it is always interesting, and it does go well with the beer. Does the beer play a role in some of the dishes as well?
It does. I try to use it as much as I can. I've used it in pizza dough and in vinaigrettes and in my chili that I served last week. And, I try to incorporate it. Beer floats are great. I can't remember if I've done a beer ice cream yet. I think I did a stout.
Yeah, you did a stout.
Yeah. So just, the two go hand in hand.
Well, it certainly sounds like something that would be delicious, you know, and ice cream. What's been the reaction to the food, being you're a little off the beaten path, certainly. Has the response been good, too?
For sure. A lot of people found me, sort of followed my whereabouts since I was at our bistro for so long, and people that I've never met come and say, oh, we loved our bistro, and we're glad we found you. And so, I think a lot of people are still surprised we have such a, I don't know if extensive is the right word for the menu, but They're surprised that it's more than just, you know, bar snacks, and they end up eating maybe when they didn't think they were coming for food. Or they say, dang it, we didn't know you had food. Next time, we'll come hungry. So that happens a lot.
Well, now, it is a small space, so, you know, people might see you behind the bar cooking. Mm-hmm. How has that been, and how was it designing that kind of space?
Well, now I know putting together, you know, maybe I'm on my fifth or sixth menu. I know what I'm capable of in that tiny space and just logistically what can happen. And, you know, I can't use too many saute pans because I don't have space to heat them and, you know, have to get creative. And then people consider me like almost part of the entertainment, I think, sometimes to my chagrin. But like, oh, you're so fun to watch back there. You're just... you know, getting food out quickly and usually quickly. And, but sometimes people don't realize that, you know, the more they talk to me, the less I'm able to get done. But they think because I'm right there, you know, like, oh, we can talk to the chef. Oh, but the chef is very busy.
So you are working and you are like right behind the bar working. But I could imagine that it would be a little bit challenging if everyone wants to just strike up a conversation just while you're working, right?
Yeah. I'm flattered that people want to engage me in conversation, but then I, you know, burn my oil or somebody is waiting for their food longer than need be because somebody had to ask me, you know, about the history of the building and where I worked before, and, you know, that kind of thing.
It's all that background that people want to know because it is an interesting building. So how old is the building?
It was built in the late 1890s. It was originally the Arath meat market and grocery store. So, and it, interestingly enough, the family, the Arath family, still lives in town. So we kind of have the history of the building and some old pictures and stuff. So.
Oh, that's very cool. That's kind of a nice connection. Well, this place is just full of connections to Indianapolis.
Yes, definitely.
So what do you see down the road? So it's been about a year. How do you see it? Do you see it growing, changing? Are you happy with things the way they are?
I'm happy with the way things are. There's a possibility of growing, but I can't really go into that right now.
Maybe somewhere down the road,
exactly.
Right? Well, what about on the food end? How has that been, you know, over the past year?
It's been fun and challenging and, you know, seeing what people are into with, you know, their drinks, and now we're serving food across the street at the distillery as well. So,
well, that was something else I wanted to talk about. So, so we've talked with Blake Jones from West Fork Whiskey. So tell me how that food arrangement is going to work on your end.
We're offering limited menu options just because it could get really hairy if, you know, it's like having the place, you know, expand by, you know, another 40 people or something, and I'm still one person cooking in a tiny space. So I have limited it right now to just a bar mix that I made just for them, different from ours, and then we're offering our paninis. And, you know, in the future I could see having, you know, like a pot of chili that I could offer their guests as well. And might expand on that, and maybe thought about doing some sort of sweet for them using some of their whiskey, like a bourbon brownie or, you know, something like that, that kind of sweet.
Well, that sounds delicious and something I'm sure would go over very well. It just seems like a very unique situation, you know, to be providing food to two establishments, you know, from one chef in one small kitchen.
Right, and I think they're just happy to not have to have a kitchen over there to provide food, so this works out great. We have rigged a POS and a doorbell so they can get, we get the message there's an order, they get the message that it's ready, so why not? And they were looking at going with somebody else initially for their food options, but I said, well, we could do the food. That makes sense. It's right there. And then when people ask us, you know, ooh, do you feel like West Fork is your competition? Absolutely not. It's a different drink altogether, different, you know, you know, distillery is completely different from a brewery, and then it's our food. So, I don't know. I think it's a great partnership.
Definitely. Yeah. I'm excited about it.
We've been talking with Mark Swartz and Aaron Kim of Cannonball Brewing Company in Indianapolis. For more information on the beer and the food, go to CannonballBrewingIndy.com or look for it on Facebook. Well, we've been talking spirits today here on Eat, Drink, Indy Radio, and that includes the upcoming Spirit and Place Festival. The festival includes more than 30 events that take place around Indianapolis, and this year each event is focused on a theme of power. That seemed to be a natural tie-in to food, says Teresa Vernon, regional director for the Kitchen Community in Indianapolis, one of the sponsors for an event called The Power of Food, Seven Short Stories. Teresa tells us how the idea for the event came about. Spirit and Place Festival, this year is going to explore and reflect on the meaning of power with 37 unique events. So if you would, Teresa, tell us about the event, The Power of Food, Seven Short Stories.
Yeah, so it just made sense because the theme power, food is literally our power. It's what fuels us.
Exactly.
It's the building blocks of every cell in our body. So it just makes sense that this is a great theme to work food into. Food is power in that it builds our families, it builds our community, it builds it's our culture, it's our tradition. There's so many aspects of how food is power. It's power in that if there is no food, it destroys communities and families people. And so there's just so many different ways to look at it. So
it's kind of a natural.
Yes, it's a natural. And storytelling, our event is a storytelling event, and everybody has a food story.
Yes, so, they do. That's true.
My organization, we're out in the field talking. As we talk to people, people share with us their food story innately. They just tell us their food story. So we thought it would be fun to put the microphone in front of people and let them be able to share it on stage.
Well, tell me about the Kitchen Community. What is that?
So the Kitchen Community, we are a national non-for-profit that launched in Indianapolis in November. So we haven't quite been here for a year.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So a new organization.
Yes, we're a new organization, and we build learning gardens in city schools, focusing on those with a high free and reduced lunch percentage in underserved communities. And so, like I said, we're out about, what we do is we build learning gardens in city schools that provide exposure to an education on real food for these kids that are in underserved schools.
So how many learning gardens do you have?
So far, we just kicked off our 27th yesterday. Our goal is...
Oh, my goodness.
I know. We've been very busy.
Yeah.
Our goal is to have 100 in Indianapolis by 2020. So we're well on our way with our 27th. So.
Oh, my goodness. Now, what is the background of the Kitchen Community?
It's a organization that started in Boulder, Colorado, co-founded by Kimball Musk.
Mm-hmm.
He... started out with restaurants and decided in Boulder, Colorado, and decided to do something for the community and went the school garden route. And it's morphed and evolved and become this very strategic, amazing organization. And he wanted to do something more at scale, and so he decided to go into other regions, and Indianapolis is the sixth.
Yes, so we're getting some restaurants.
Real food restaurants.
Right, and these learning gardens.
Exactly.
So it's a really cool initiative, I think. And it certainly ties in, like you said, with power and food access and that sort of thing. Have you had a good reception to the gardens?
Absolutely. Well, the schools absolutely love them, as do the community. I mean, our tagline is community through food. And so, again, back to that power thing of how food is power is and building communities. And so it strengthens the school. It strengthens the school community. It strengthens the kids by encouraging them to eat healthy, real food, creating these lifelong behavior habits that will hopefully,
it would take hold.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
So, what do the children do? Do they actually raise food? Do you actually have a garden? Are there, you know, what's it like?
It's so the kids, the schools, each school maintains their garden. Our program team works with the school to assure that they have a healthy, thriving garden to help the caterpillars that ate all the kale over the summer, which I don't know if you have a garden, but they ate there's some sort of caterpillar that came in and ate all my kale, and apparently that happened in all the schools as well. So the program team went in and remedied that by replanting the kale, so when the kids came back to school in the fall, there would be kale. And, you know, it's like things like that, or Edison School for the Arts had a groundhog that kept on jumping up and eating all the food. So, you know, our program team works with the school to make sure that they have a healthy, thriving garden to get the food in the kids' bellies, which is our ultimate goal. But the school does maintain the garden. The teachers, the garden team works with the students, and they plant the crops. We provide all the seeds and starts and the growing the garden plants, but they do all the planting and harvesting themselves and maintaining the gardens.
And they get to actually enjoy the food,
yes,
right?
That is absolutely the number one goal, is to have the children enjoy the food.
Oh, that's
awesome. The teachers will harvest the produce and bring it into the classroom for salad tasting days, or some of the schools will send it home in a backpack program, or Beech Grove City Schools, they actually launched a garden to cafeteria and getting the produce that they harvested into their actual cafeteria.
So. Oh, that's great. That is inspiring.
We've been talking with Teresa Vernon, Regional Director for the Kitchen Community in Indianapolis. We'll be right back with more on The Power of Food, 7 Short Stories, part of the upcoming Spirit and Place Festival in Indianapolis, here on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, talking with Teresa Vernon, Regional Director for the Kitchen Community in Indianapolis, about the upcoming Spirit and Place Festival, the event The Power of Food, 7 Short Stories, and how the kitchen community came to be involved.
How did the work with the kitchen communities lead to the idea of participating in Spirit and Place?
Yeah, that's a great question. My prior job with the IU School of Medicine, I helped with a couple storytelling events that were wildly successful. And so launching the kitchen community here in Indianapolis, I told Laura Henderson, my program manager, that I wanted to do a storytelling event to just get the word out about what the kitchen community is doing. And she has been involved with Spirit and Place previously, and she said we should do this as part of Spirit and Place, and the theme is power. So again, how closely that they're linked, power and food. So it was just a perfect match.
Now, tell me a little bit about the actual event. What's going to take place? You know, you have a short story, kind of a competition?
Yes, it's 7 short stories, 7 7-minute stories about the power of food. And so our storytellers lined up. Well, first of all, I'm thrilled that Dan Wakefield is going to be one of our storytellers.
Oh, my goodness.
Talk
awesome.
About the ultimate storyteller. So he will have a story. We will have a storyteller that is an 11-year-old student that is in, I'm not going to tell what the stories are about, but he's one of our schools that has a learning garden. We have somebody talking about the power of food in the Jewish tradition, and then just a few other storytellers. So it's a very broad base of stories. Like I said, everybody has a food story. So what
will happen? Is there audience participation?
Well, so the audience, when they come in, when people, guests come in, they will be given a card that has a little food knowledge. We just want to see what kind of knowledge people have of real food. So they'll have an opportunity to do a little quiz. You know, the other great thing, too, is our event is being held at Shortridge High School, which if you've never been to the historic Caleb Mills Auditorium, it is spectacular.
It is beautiful, isn't
it? It's beautiful, yes. So I think that's going to be a draw in itself, just so people coming in to see this auditorium that's in a high school, historic high school in Indianapolis, and the auditorium is on Indiana National Landmarks. And Dan Wakefield is a graduate.
Yes, right? So there's a lot of connections there.
And so we thought it was appropriate that people take a little test as they come into the high school. And so they'll be tested on their real food knowledge. And on the reverse of the card will be an opportunity for them to vote on which one they think will be the they think is the most impactful.
One of the stories,
yes.
Oh, that's great. So what's the goal of that? What happens, you know, after they listen to all the stories? And so there's voting and you award a winner?
We do. We will award a winner, obviously, based on the audience. It's more than just allowing audience participation. The actual storytelling is almost personal development for people. Rob Friedman, he is a professional storytelling coach. He was the speechwriter for the CEO for Lilly for years, and he hosted a storytelling workshop for our storytellers as sort of a personal development. So it's more, the voting part is more for the storytellers, just to see how to do their personal best in as far as storytelling.
And see how well they connected with the audience.
Exactly. Yes, and that's what storytelling is all about, is making the connection. These stories will be new to the audience, but that's the point of storytelling, is to make that connection, that emotional connection with the storyteller.
Now, so what else is part of the event? Learning Garden tour?
Yes. Yeah, so we have a Learning Garden. One of our Kitchen Community Learning Gardens is at Butler Lab right across the street, Butler Lab Elementary School. So people can see. They also have their own garden and chickens at that school. So it's pretty phenomenal.
I wondered if there were some chickens involved.
Yes, there are. that's the new trend these days, to have chickens at schools, which is awesome. So they could see firsthand on how the power food impacts children. And then they will, again, come into the high school and take their real food quiz, listen to the stories. And then afterwards, there's a real food reception where some local organizations will have booths and tables, and people, the audience, can interact with them. And there's a few local food providers that will be providing reception snacks, real food snacks.
Oh, well, that's terrific. Now, we'll be talking about, you know, will you be talking about, you know, food access and, you know, the problem of food deserts and, you know, healthy eating?
Yeah, and so this isn't, it's not a panel. It's more storytelling. And some of the stories will be about lack of food access or lack of food education. But it's more to demonstrate this through storytelling. The reception afterwards, there will be organizations that talk about what they're doing to address this. Yes, but the actual event, the storytelling event, is we wanted to keep people. There's so many organizations that are doing wonderful things in the city, the kitchen community included. But we wanted it to be more of an emotional tie to the community with people's real stories.
Now, was it difficult to get the participants? You know, were people willing to tell their stories, or was that a challenge?
I think, like I said, everybody has a food story, but getting people willing to stand up, be vulnerable enough to stand up and tell their own personal story, that is a challenge.
It could be tough
because anybody could stand up. Almost anybody. I have stage fright, but anybody can stand up in front of an audience and tell facts and data. But to be vulnerable and tell your own story, it's a very powerful tool. Again, power.
Right.
And so that's what we wanted to really keep it at. Tell your own personal story.
Now, was it a competition to get into the program?
Yeah, we did a call for applications. Mostly because we wanted to make sure we had a broad, diverse group of stories. We didn't want everybody to come and talk about food insecurity issues, or we just wanted a very broad selection of stories.
Do you feel like it represents the work that you're doing, you know, with the kitchen community? Is this a Is this an event that seemed to just sort of come together and be a good fit?
Well, aside from the 11-year-old that is in one of the schools, none of the stories are about us. And nobody. I'm not one of the storytellers. We wanted to step back and let the community.
Okay.
Like I said earlier, we hear so many people's food stories. We just thought this would be a great chance to let them get up and talk about it themselves. So it's more about the people and their own individual stories as opposed to the kitchen community. And we're just one of the four co-collaborators, and I'm the one. You had to put one person's name down amongst launching a nonprofit in Indianapolis. This
right.
is just another one of my. I was lucky one that got to spearhead this.
Now, who are the other collaborators with the project?
It's Growing Places Indy, Flanner House, and Shortridge High School, and Green Bean Delivery. Green Bean Delivery is they are. Awarding each of the storytellers a basket of real food.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes.
Now tell me again when and where the event takes place.
Yes, it's at Shortridge High School on 34th and Meridian on Sunday, November 5th from 3 to 5. The storytelling is from 3 to 4 o'clock. And I do want to say that the night before is... daylight saving time fall back, so I'm terrified that people are going to show up and
oh, no.
you know, forget to turn their clocks. So,
now is there a charge for attending?
No, it's open
a free
to the
event?
Public. It's a free event. We ask that you RSVP, and you can RSVP on Spirit and Place's website. We ask that you RSVP because the auditorium, again, it's a Broadway size auditorium. It's huge, and we want to. Section off seats so people aren't spread out all over the auditorium that we want to section off seats. So we'd like to know approximately how many people are going to be there.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for talking with
us.
Thank
you for having me.
We've been talking with Teresa Vernon of the Kitchen Community in Indianapolis about The Power of Food, 7 Short Stories, part of the 2017 Spirit and Place Festival. For more information, go to spiritandplace.org. Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2, The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our spirited show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Teresa Vernon of the Kitchen Community in Indianapolis, Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey, and Mark Swartz and Aaron Kim of Cannonball Brewing Company. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie.